Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading text 3 from Canto 4, Chapter 4. Sati quits her body. First she quit home. This verse. Tato vinishasya sati vihayatam shokina rosena chaduyata hrida petror agat straina vimuta dirgatan prematvano yordham adhat satam priyaha. Tato vinishvasya sati vihayatam shokena rosena chaduyata rada pitror agat staina vimuta dirgat grahan prematmano yordham adat satam priyaha. Tataha. Then, vinishvasya, breathing very heavily. Sati. Sati. Vihaya. Leaving. Tam. Him. Lord Shiva. Shokena. By bereavement. Roshena. By anger. Cha. And. Duyata. Afflicted. Hrida. With the heart. Pitroho. Of her father. Agat. She went. Straina. By her womanly nature. Vimodha, deluded. Dhi, intelligence. Grahan, to the house. Primna, due to affection. Atmanaha, of his body. Yaha, who? Ardham, half. Adat, gave satam to the saintly priyaha dear. Translation: thereafter, Sati left her husband, Lord Shiva, who had given her half his body due to affection, breathing very heavily because of anger and bereavement. She went to the house of her father. This less intelligent act was due to her being a weak woman. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. According to the Vedic conception of family life, the husband gives half his body to his wife. Here you go, dear. And the wife gives half of her body to her husband. Thank you very much. Here's half of my body too. In other words, a husband without a wife, or a wife without a husband, is incomplete. Vedic marital relationship existed between Lord Shiva and Sati, but sometimes, due to weakness, a woman becomes very much attracted to the members of her father's house. And this happened to Sati. In this verse, it is specifically mentioned that she wanted to leave such a great husband as Shiva because of her womanly weakness. In other words, this is a big surprise, but listen to this. Womanly weakness exists even in the relationship between husband and wife. Generally, now this is, you know, American women don't like to hear this. This is Prabhupada being part of India's culture. So that's how they read this. It's called hermeneutics. Give it a fancy name. Generally, separation between husband and wife is due to womanly behavior. Divorce takes place due to womanly weakness. The best course for a woman is to abide by the orders of her husband. That makes family life very peaceful. Sometimes there may be misunderstandings between husband and wife, as found even in such an elevated family relationship as that of Sati and Lord Shiva. But a wife should not leave her husband's protection because of such a misunderstanding. If she does so, it is understood to be due to her womanly weakness. I don't know if this would pass the test of grihastha counseling in our modern context of things. But the context here is Lord Shiva is unquestionably qualified. So the ideal is where the husband is unquestionably qualified. That's the ideal. And the ideal for a woman is to follow an ideal qualified husband. And then everything is very nice. Disturbance comes when one of the two is lacking in qualification. It's called Kali Yuga. And that's where marriage counseling comes in. Because he's not eminently qualified and she's not eminently qualified, and he knows how she's not qualified and she knows how he's not qualified, and that's the finger pointing. Well, he's not qualified. Well, she's not qualified. The standard, once again, is the husband is qualified. At least qualified in the sense of knowing what are the standards and following the standards. And the wife's qualification is to follow the husband, who knows what are the standards and following the standards. There will be friction. Commonly, the example Prabhupada would point to is bamboo. In a bamboo forest, the wind blows. And what happens? The bamboo bends, and this bamboo hits another bamboo, and there's some loud noise and sparks. But no one takes it so seriously because it's just the wind blowing in a bamboo forest. And similarly, between husband and wife, there may be some wind blowing in the bamboo forest. There may be some social dealing that's just because of the proximity of the two. You have a bamboo over here and a bamboo over there. Wind blows, nothing happens. But bamboo grows close together. And so that's why the example is not oak trees, it's bamboo. Because they grow close together. And then when the wind blows and they bend and poof, loud sound. But no one pays so much attention. Especially if you live near a bamboo forest and you hear it all the time, so that you don't pay much attention. If you're just passing by and you hear that loud sound, it may be like living in Brooklyn and hearing the A train rumbling underneath the building and everyone goes, "Whoa, it's an earthquake." No, it's the A train. Don't worry about it, it's okay. It's just the A train rumbling through. I've had that experience. People that are from California and they're taking rest and they can't sleep because it sounds like an earthquake every 10 minutes. I'm used to it, so I sleep right through it. And all the other sounds of New York. But go to Gita Nagari, and I was sleeping in the cabin. I couldn't sleep at night because the frogs, and there's a pond right outside, and the frog concert at night. I couldn't sleep. I wasn't used to that sound. So you live near a bamboo forest, you get used to that sound. You live in a marriage or near a marriage, and you get used to there's. But in the final analysis, it's not taken seriously. And as Prabhupada would say, the next moment everything is fine. When that this ideal situation is there, the husband and the wife are qualified. So this whole thing is often like used as a stick to hit the wife, saying, "You're not following your husband." And the real problem is the husband's not qualified. Prabhupada once shared like that. The whole reason for the women's liberation movement is because men aren't qualified. And as a class, the women are looking at the men saying, "Wow, they're not qualified. I'm not going to follow them. I'm going my own way." So the solution, Prabhupada said, is you men, you should become qualified. Which is true. Because when, in normal circumstances, when a man is qualified, a woman feels very safe and protected and happy. I'll be happy to follow. But then comes this situation like Jai Jagannath was bringing up yesterday, when someone is qualified, but the capacity to see how they're qualified and how they're properly following is not clear. And then it's, "Hey, what's going on? You're not qualified." Because one can't see it. Perhaps because one's not so qualified. Or because the differences of approach are such that one can't understand who's qualified, who's not qualified, and then it comes into the dissension program. So it's great to have ideal situations. Therefore, men should be properly trained. Komara acharet pragyo dharman bhagavatanya. From the tender age of childhood. But that training is absent. Someone was pointing out, it was in our GBC meeting. Shesha Prabhu, who is, he has two ministries. One is active and the other is not so active. One is the justice ministry. It's, he's not doing much because there's too much going on. But the education development ministry is quite active. So he made a presentation before our GBCs about the importance of that. It was in relation to our strategic planning efforts, and he wanted to elevate the role of education. So one of the references he made, I didn't take the time to double check it, but he was explaining, I think it's in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, somewhere, Prabhupada speaks about the Goswamis of Vrindavan. And that they're not qualified unless there's proper training. So it's not just by birth you become a Goswami any more than by birth you become a Brahmana, not in the age of Kali, but by training and education. And Prabhupada was saying because of the absence of that training and education, the Goswamis of Vrindavan aren't today qualified. That's a pretty bold thing to say in his Bhagavad Gita purport, if that's what Prabhupada wrote, but it's the principle is in our present age, strong training and education is required to bring out the qualities, better qualities. Because the converse is, or in the absence of strong training and education, what do you have? Polished animal life at best. Polished animal life meaning sense gratification is it. That's the game. And polished sense gratification is you do it nicely. You know, put a nice ribbon and a bow and some perfume and do it nicely. But sense gratification is the program. Polished. Meaning where the absence of a higher goal prevails. Like, what's the soul? What's the trajectory of the soul towards its ultimate destination? None of that. Just you have this like souped up machine called the human form of life, and it's meant for sense gratification. And you just polish how you do the sense gratification. Eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, polished. And Prabhupada would spend so much time describing. The dog eats out of a bowl and the man eats out of a plate. He eats on the floor and the man eats at the table. But the eating is the same program. And so forth. Sleeping on the floor, sleeping in a bed. Or in a penthouse apartment where there's a bed. Or on the floor. Or under a tree. But, you know, sleeping and sleeping. And mating and mating. We won't go into details. And defending. And, you know, guns and weapons and just defending. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending. Polished. That's polished animal life. It's animal life. Take out the adjective. It's animal life. And human life is meant to go beyond animal life. So training and education is not just how to be a polished animal in sophisticated ways, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And education is meant for something far more than that. So that the higher nature, the higher purpose of the soul's mission in the human form of life is achieved. It takes training and education, a purification process. Ours is Mahamantra, the sacred sound of Krishna's holy name and the sacred sound of the scripture. So there's the information and the heart cleansing, and then the practical application in the association of devotees where there's teachers and guides and persons helping us accomplish that. Training and education is needed. Our temples are meant for such purpose, and our temples are meant to set a standard, an example, for the congregation members that don't have that same intensity of training and education, but here's the model. Apply it in your home. Deity worship, kirtan, hearing the scripture, keeping things clean, proper achar. Example. And doing the service of conducting educational classes and programs and so forth to explain the principles and how to apply them. That's our function as temple residents. And our congregation members also doing the same by learning and then exemplifying. So when there's the proper training, and the boy is to be trained one way, the girl sees the same fundamental training, but the role, societal role, is different, appropriate for their gender, and when coming together as husband and wife, then it's very nice, as far as the progressive values of life are concerned. It can lead one in that direction. It's meant to. So now, here we have a problem. And the problem is vimudha dhi. Dhi, D-H-I, indicates intelligence. And mudha indicates, well, foolish or misapplication of intelligence. And vimudha dhi is strongly foolish in the application of intelligence, misguided intelligence. Deluded intelligence, in the word for word. Intelligence that's just like Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita. What happens when there's contemplation of the object of the senses, that means in the mood of enjoyment, the mind becomes bewildered. When the mind becomes bewildered, the intelligence becomes vimudha. It's like there's an object, and there's water, and there's a reflection of the object in the water. And when there's a wind, then the reflection becomes distorted. So the mind, when contemplating an object, is like that's the wind agitating the mind, and then the capacity to discern what's the object, it's gone. It's the sense gratification program, how to take this object and use it in sense gratification. It's just, it's gone. The higher intelligence, sthita dhi, in the language of Bhagavad Gita, steady intelligence. That's possible. Steady intelligence is not possible by a mechanical means. Steady intelligence is possible with devotion, because Krishna gives it. I had this discussion with the Ayurvedic doctor that I see. He had all these. His Ayurvedic teacher saw him to be amongst his students the best, and so he gave him all these. I think they came from Tibet. Very ancient leaves, like, you know, manuscripts in the form of leaves with, in Sanskrit, all kinds of teachings written on very, very old leaves, you know, in books. On, you know, he opened up the cloth, boom, 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 and then pulled out this whole stack of leaves. And, you know, there were Ayurvedic teachings on the mind. I said, wow, this will be a big hit, and, you know, you'll publish this stuff, translate it and publish it, you'll get a lot of people to buy. What do the Vedas say about the mind? People are really interested in minds. And all kinds of other things that the Ayurveda speaks about. So, you know, one was about the intelligence. And he was saying, you know, by this and that and the other thing, then one can have steady intelligence, dita dhi. And I was surprised. I surprised myself. I erupted and said, no way. By this and that and the other thing. You know better. You're a doctor and you've already explained this to me. You can line things up very nicely. But if what's behind that is the lifestyle of the person, or what their objectives or goal of life is, not spiritual, it's not going to stay in place. You know that very well. You've explained it to me, so stop this. You can have steady intelligence by, you know, doing something with your Ayurvedic medicines. Forget it. I mean, it can be helpful, sure. Mode of goodness is always helpful. But it can't create steady intelligence. That's when there's shelter in the personality of Godhead. That's the only way. And he apologized. He was a little, I surprised myself too, how I, like, hey, wait a minute. But that's part of training. Dharman Bhagavata Iha. That's the training. Starting point of training. So when that training is there, then there's qualification. And when that training is absent, there's the absence of disqualification. And then one's intelligence becomes lost. Vimudhadi. Now, what's the cause behind the Vimudhadi for Sati? Because for her, or for a woman, the intelligence is follow the qualified husband. Just like for a student, the intelligence is follow the qualified teacher. It doesn't mean like turn your thoughtfulness into the off position and just be a zombie and just follow. Like, you know, robot. Mindless robot. Not that. But when the intelligence is active, let me follow this qualified person. And the student follows the qualified teacher, and the disciple follows the, but, you know, and in the course of doing so, so many things become understood that otherwise weren't understood by that descending process. The enlightenment comes by that submission. Krishna's mercy comes by one's submission unto Krishna. It's like Krishna saying in Bhagavad Gita, surrender unto me, and I'll protect you from all sinful reactions. Do not fear. So, how do I know before I surrender unto Krishna that's a good program? So there's some element of faith. It's not blind faith, it's very carefully considered, where do I place my faith? So when the light's on, somebody's home, and they're considering, why should I place my faith in Krishna? And with deliberation, I place my faith in Krishna. So many things that weren't understood become understood. Like, who is Krishna? Bhaktyamam abhijanati yavanyascha. So, do we surrender into Krishna because before we surrender to Krishna, we fully understand Krishna, then before we surrender to Him? Not possible. Because you can't fully understand Krishna without devotional service. And what's devotional service without submission? And what's submission without faith? And what's faith? It's just a robot. That's not faith. But when there's thoughtful consideration and one places one's faith upon Krishna, then Krishna can be seen. Krishna can be, His personality can be understood. His name being non-different from Him can be understood. This is Krishna. I'm associating with Krishna by chanting. Prior to that, it's faith. But faith with reason. This topic of faith and reason is such an important theological issue that when Tamal Krishna Maharaj returned back to his undergraduate studies at Southern Methodist University after, you know, a whole career of Hare Krishna movement, he purposefully, because he was a very purposeful individual, when he had papers to write, it was on this topic, thinking ahead of time, when it's done, I'll publish a book on faith and reason, because theologically, on what basis does one place one's faith? Is it just faith? Just believe? Or what's the role of reason? Is it just reason? And so there's theological, you know, points of view on faith and reason. So that his book that was published was just a collection of his essays on faith and reason. What's the role? In short, I'm saying faith has combined with it the faculty of reason. Just like we place, of the three ways of knowing something, direct sense perception, pratyaksha, reason and logic, anuman, and scriptural authority, shabda. Shabda is the final one. But how do you understand shabda? You have to apply faith and reason. Otherwise, how can you understand it? But it's not, the essence is faith and reason, and then I can understand it. It's shabda. It has its own strength. But I have to bring the faculty of reason to approach that shabda. Otherwise, you're a zombie. Or you're a machine that has no, you know, what's the life inside the machine? You're bringing your consciousness with some faith. The fact that you're just bringing it to shabda is an act of faith instead of something else. Like what materialists do. Forget scripture, just figure it out. Speculate till the cows come home and, you know, lifetime after lifetime. So, Sati's intelligence became bewildered because she departed from that which her better intelligence told her. Her weaker intelligence was, I want to go to the party. I want to be with my father. I want to be in that social atmosphere. Look at all those persons going to enjoy the party, the festival, the yajna. I want to go. And in the course of doing, shokena, roshena, cha duyata hrida, in the verse, she was, even before she went, it was bereavement. Bereavement because she's departing from this higher nature. That's the bereavement. And shokena, shoka, harsha, shoka. She's lamenting. It's anger. She has some anger towards her husband. Why are you not letting me go? And duyata rida. She has affliction in her heart. That's a time when you should pause, not when you should bolt or act impulsively. You're feeling afflicted within the heart. Hit the pause button. Cool down. She didn't do that. She left. And the rest of the verse is saying something that's culturally interesting and a little difficult to understand. Specifically, the last line, premna, due to affection, her husband gave half of his body to her. And so Prabhupada is explaining, when there's marriage, the husband gives half of his body to the wife gives half of her body to the husband. I've never heard that quite expressed quite like that before. I've heard the wife is the better half. I think that's common. The better half. But half of what? Half of his body. The wife, so he's giving his, not his body, but half his body to the wife. And she's... Anyway, Prabhupada explains that what that means is a husband without a wife or a wife without a husband is incomplete. So it's like a commitment. My completeness is with you. Somehow it comes down to he gave half of his body to her. So having that Vedic, specifically it says in the purport, Vedic marital relationship existed between Lord Shiva and Sati. So it was formalized. And she left, despite that formalization. Not good. From not good decisions and behaviors that follows those decisions, not good outcomes. Don't expect good outcomes when you make bad decisions. Take responsibility for those bad decisions. And when it comes in the form of a bad outcome, then he gets into this, cultural thing. It's the woman's fault. not exactly what he says, but it sounds like what he's saying. Commonly, the situation of when there is separation between a religiously married husband and wife has to do with the wife's departing from her position of being subordinate and submissive to her husband. Now, back to the contemporary situation, what if the husband's not qualified? You know, that should have been thought about before marriage. And quite often, whatever, if the sincerity of husband is there by submissively following the husband, it helps the qualification come from the sources of descending mercy, like Krishna. If elsewhere in the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada describes, if the husband is unqualified, if he's deviating from the lotus feet of Vishnu or Krishna, going in that direction, the wife need not follow the husband going in that direction. So there are other statements indicating there are discretionary points where a wife is not to follow. But then it gets into this gray area where their following may be supportive of the husband coming to the right position again. So I don't know if we need to go there with, you know, all of those innuendos, but at least mention it. Once again, take it from the top. We're speaking of the ideal situation here, where unquestionably qualified is Lord Shiva. And he's made his direction very clear. It wasn't a no, don't go, but he made his direction very clear. And she's leaving that situation. So her protection is now abandoned. Bad decision, bad consequences, as Lord Shiva predicted. If you go, very bad consequences. Okay, any discussion? That's right. Yes, faith and everything else. That's right. Well, there's some preliminary faith that there's something out there that's not contaminated, that's pure and ideal. And then Krishna sends sadhu, sangha. So I take that sadhu sangha very seriously, recognizing my own limitations at the same time not being a blind follower and receiving that which strongly resonates, knowing I've got my filter program is going. So I can't, you know, I have to be careful just even with that which is coming in that says yes. I have to be careful. But one step at a time. And continuing to be receptive of the transcendental association and continuing the cleansing process, like, you know, the process of bhakti itself, hearing, chanting, etc., cleanses that cloudy condition. So that I'm trusting that fact, I'm trusting the process of bhakti itself and the association that gradually I can more clearly understand, minus or with less filters. Step by step. Each step being thoughtfully made. What's the alternative? Just stay stuck. That's not a good alternative, good option to choose. So to just move forward blindly, that's not a good option to choose. Move forward thoughtfully, knowing that I have my limitations. being very careful where I hear from. Jitendriya. I've heard that one. Yes. Yes. Well, that depends on the qualification of the parents, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Certainly, appreciation and respect. Appreciation for what one has received, and respect for all the sacrifices, etc., that they have performed. But the regard very much depends upon their qualification. How much I open myself to that which they'd like to pass on. I may not want to receive that which they'd like to pass on. Although that doesn't change my position of respect and appreciation for what I received and the sacrifices they have made. I need not necessarily accept their values. So the discriminating factor has to be there. In all religions, including Vedic tradition, honor thy father and mother is, you know, standard. So, and to what degree and in which ways one honors one's father and mother is very much dependent upon their spiritual standing, their quality of spiritual elevation, or the absence of it. So it doesn't take away the basic fabric of the relationship, but it does determine the degree to which I'm honoring and the ways in which I'm honoring. One can, I mean, like, you know, Hiranyakashipu and Prahlad. Nice example. He never dishonored his father, but he didn't go for his program. Okay? Yes. Speak a little. Yeah, don't be a robot. Don't be a blind follower. Right. Hit the reset button. Because that's not what it is. It's what it isn't. So now what is it? It's a devotional process. It's not a vending machine process. It's not a mechanical process. Put some ingredients together and voila. It's devotional. Krishna is reciprocating with the love with which we offer things to him. That's nice. We want nice ingredients because it's for Krishna. But we want the loving exchange. That's what we want. That's what Krishna wants too. He doesn't need ingredients. So it's learning by association and purification and training and education what devotional life is. It's devotional. Not behaviors or mechanical things. It's there are behaviors and there are things, but it's love. The loving exchange between oneself and Krishna. Anything on the lady's side? Okay. Yes, Jai Jagannath. It very much depends upon the person, but you know, put it in the fast lane for the training department. For if they haven't gotten married yet, you know, don't run off and get married before you're ready to understand what that's all about, and you can handle the situation. That's one piece of advice. Tell family members to, you know, step back. I'm getting some training now. Thank you very much. And when not trained in a situation, you know, it varies from case to case, person to person. But quite often, you know, there's the problems due to lack of training become very evident very quickly. At least for a thoughtful person. You know, a mindless person just keeps going like a donkey. But a thoughtful person understands, wow, I don't really know what I'm doing here. And I don't know how to, you know, I jumped in feet first and now I don't know how to swim. Better, you know, get some swimming lessons. So little, you know, time out from trying to like run forward with the marriage program and go slowly and take some time for training. It depends on the person and the relationship and, you know, the whole picture. Better training. And ideal is training from childhood. But, you know, at whatever point it becomes understood I need some training, then you seriously take it. Rara, you have something? Not exactly. They don't separate from one another. They separate from the scene. You know, the family scene. They go on pilgrimage to holy places. Or they go to the forest. Or they just don't engage them, you know, for austerities. Vana means forest. Right? Vrindavana. The forest of Vrinda. So they go to the forest and engage in detaching themselves from family life and instead accepting a life of reducing the sense of comforts as a source of happiness and finding an internal happiness. Sure. You go to that's the principle of going to the holy place. Well, it depends on the persons. It depends on the individuals. Yeah, it depends on the temple too, but very much it's even more depends upon the individuals. Like Radharman and his wife, you know, Their children are grown up married, and so as soon as they take care of that nice house they have, condominium they have, they're going to move close to the temple and, you know, have enough income, part-time something, so they can maintain and just do full-time service. That's one model. Or, you know, Vrindavan or Mayapur or something like that. So it's one of the weak of the four ashrams, it's the weakest as far as example and, you know, having ourselves set up to like take care of, you know, but it's not really strong in any one of the four ashrams. brahmachari, grahastha, and sannyas ashrams, like you know. But of the four, we're the least prepared. But it depends upon the individuals, and also their willingness to take up vanaprastha life. Some of them just want to keep going, working, visiting their kids, and just stay very involved in family and the whole program. Like another example comes to mind is Tamahara and Mantrini. Their children are all grown up, their children are all married, their children are devotees. Now, what do they do with their life? So, a practical arrangement is when they were married, they provided a place for their children. Now that they're vanaprastha, their children are providing a place for their parents. So one of their daughters is married and has a house that has an upstairs and they're living upstairs. Or something, you know, one part of the house. And they're doing full-time service for our society. He's doing this, she's doing that. And they're very happy. He doesn't have income. So there's some charity here and there and some part-time something. And, you know, he's stitching it together and his costs are limited so he can do service for our society. And to a degree, you know, the grandparenting and continuing to be, you know, the guiding his or their children in their married life and staying on track and so on. A little involved in family, but largely involved in just serving. The society widely. So there are examples. Well, that was a haven for examples, good and bad mixed. But there are places where that goes on. Mayapur is definitely a place where that goes on. There's examples. I'm in communication with a god brother who I didn't have much association with, but he was very involved in book distribution, got married, had three children. The children are now grown up, nearly in the entering marriage stage. So he's in his vanaprastha phase and going out and, you know, kirtan and doing programs and, you know, it's a vanaprastha stage. I don't know if his wife travels with him, but he's got his circuit moving around and, has his little place to stay. It's not in Alachua, but it's in Florida. He's growing his wings of detachment and the spirit of preaching, and there's not a whole support structure by the society to take care of him and his wife, but he's a very active, dynamic preacher. And he's very happy. And I assume his wife is also happy. And at vanaprastha stage. It's not abundant. There was a Jananda, maybe Jitendri knows Jananda. Real tall. Okay. I don't know what his wife's name is. He's now sannyasi. But so he entered into vanaprastha stage and he wanted to start a vanaprastha ministry with the understanding that there's a sannyas ministry, there's a grahastha ministry, there are a lot of brahmacharis in our society, but hey, you know, who's setting the example and giving teachings about how to be a vanaprastha? So he wanted to start a ministry. It didn't get any traction and his interest started going in the direction of sannyas, so he did that instead. Okay? You do? Sure, you can always come here. We have to, you know, before the temple accepts a person to come here, we'd have to consider what's the package. You know, the person, their commitment, their responsibility. Here's an old person. What about their health care? What about their personality? What about this? What about that? There's a lot of considerations before just like, hey, come on in and park yourself. Okay. There should be more thought. We want to be more thoughtful, not just, you know, possessed of blind sentiment. That, okay, here's somebody that's done a lot of, you know, they've done their thing, come on in. Or a brahmachari, hey, come on in, or, you know, whatever, come on in. Grahastha, come on in, sure. This, you know, the Prabhupada built a house in which the whole world could live. Come on in. Wait a minute. There's some considerations here. Okay. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.